We're going to bring on Ryan Grimm from the Huffington Post. Ryan, welcome to the FDH Lounge tonight, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, it's good to have you on. I read your book, which your publisher very graciously forwarded to us here, a book about the state of the drug war and essentially the background behind it and some of the things historically leading up to it. There are some notions in there, I think, that people vaguely had in terms of the previous acceptability of drugs as they were. But you go into some detail about that, particularly, I think, some 19th century stuff where there was actually some actual mass marketing in terms of mass marketing in the standards of that day and age of opiates and opiate accessories and everything like that. That part of it was certainly interesting and surprising.
Yeah, that was one of the fun parts for me because I had, like you said, I had a vague awareness that there was some history in America with drug use prior to the hippie days. I didn't have any idea of the extent of it. There was this just amazing drug epidemic, nationwide party sort of in the 1890s, where you had Sears Roebuck selling cocaine kits with syringes through their catalog. Drugstores really were drugstores. Like, you showed up and you bought drugs. You could buy cocaine, you could buy amphetamines, you could buy heroin, which was introduced as a non-addictive replacement to morphine, which had been introduced as a non-addictive substitute for just smoking opium. So, it was part of our never-ending search for a better drug that gets you higher but doesn't get you addicted is what led to this this epidemic in the 1890s, and then ultimately led to a reaction against it, and you see that build, and then we get prohibition, and then we react against that. And so our history with drugs is just one big series of actions and counteractions, and we can never find the balance.
What accounts for, do you think, because this is very interesting in my mind, when you get into the post-war period, late 40s, you get into the 1950s, early part of the 1960s, what accounts for this historical amnesia then of nobody ever knew anybody who took drugs or whatever, or there might be this forbidden subculture, but we don't really know much about that, and then the 60s happen, and oh my God, where did this stuff come from? What essentially accounts for the national amnesia of that 20 years or so?
If you put the American people on the couch, you'd find that we're not a people that have much of a memory for anything, really. And maybe that has something to do with just how young our country is. We're people who are always, looking onward and forward. Go west, young man. President Obama, he comes into office. He doesn't want to look back and find out what happened during the Bush years. He wants to look forward, and this forward-looking posture is, it's kind of part of the American psyche. We left the old world behind, and here we are. We don't learn from our economic mistakes and our cultural mistakes, so it's not surprising that we don't learn from our drug mistakes. But, drugs are the kind of thing that is experience-based, that if one generation doesn't experience a certain drug, then the memory, the collective memory of it, vanishes because, memories are held in brains, and brains are the things that get high. So I think it's a combination of those two things.
Well, one of the things that was also interesting in the book, and very counterintuitive, and I'll admit counterintuitive from how I think about these things, was what you said in there about California, that since medical marijuana was introduced, as a form of legality within the state there, that teenage drug use had actually, teenage pot use, let's narrow it to that, had actually been reported as going down. And again, let's call it what it is, medical marijuana, whatever. I mean, it's in a large part de facto legalization for the better part of this decade. Look at how Johnny Drama got his, for God's sake, go find somebody to scratch you a prescription. So that part of it there is very counterintuitive.
Oh, absolutely. California is an interesting place because, as you say, it really is de facto legalization. The thing is that marijuana works as a medicinal drug for extremely light ailments and extremely difficult ones because It reduces nausea. Now it combats cramps. So there, half of the population is eligible for it right there. It's even good for a hangover. So it's the sort of thing where if a doctor, recommends it, then this medical pot shop is going to sell it to you. And you have a lot of liberal doctors out there who say, hey, you've got nausea, smoke a little pot. So you're right. It has become de facto legalization. And what's surprising to the drug warriors is that the sky hasn't collapsed in California. They're selling pot in stores to people that walk in off the street. Those pot stores are paying taxes, and things are going on just fine. So in 2010, they're probably going to put it on the ballot to do away with the shred and just look. It's legal for everybody if you want to walk in and buy it. So we'll see how that goes, but they won't be able to use like a scare tactic of, you're going to have an increase in teen drug use or some of the other prominent arguments, because as you said, surprisingly, drug use went down after 1996, and it went down. Not only did it go down, but it went down by more than the national average. So you can't just say, well, pot use was going down everywhere. No, it went down there more than pretty much everywhere else. Like, it's a strange situation. Maybe bringing it out in the open takes some of the stigma away from it, makes it a little less cool for kids.
Before I ask you the next question and set up a little scenario here with you here, I want to make sure that I'm not mischaracterizing your position or anything like that. As far as it goes from the book, is it fair to say that you draw as a moral from the book that there should not only be legalization of pot, but at least to whatever extent of harder drugs as well?
Yeah, I consciously didn't make it a policy book because there are a lot of smart policy experts out there doing that work to focus on the history and the present situation. But you're right; it's fair to draw from that I think that people shouldn't be in prison for any drug. Now, what I also learned from writing the book is if overnight we just legalized every drug, it would be chaos, and you'd have a whole surge in addiction rates, and we'd freak out, prohibit everything again. So if I were going to prescribe something for lawmakers, I'd say the way to do it is the way we are doing it, is state by state, county by county, so that the country gets used to it. And first the country has to get used to marijuana. Let's be realistic, before they're going to come in and legalize something like cocaine. So that would be a long way down the road. But just as a moral issue, I think if somebody wants to do something that harms themselves or makes themselves feel good, that should be that person, and not they shouldn't wind up in jail for it.
Well, I wanted to clarify where you were coming at on that before I asked you this, because cards on the table. I'm just basically your average Midwest paleo con. So I mean, I'm not somebody who comes at this, all right, as somebody who's necessarily really sympathetic to the end game here in terms of legalization. Here's the thing, and I'm not trying to caricature anybody's position or anything like that, but you've got the crowd that's legalize it, man. Here's the thing: we're never going to have full on what I would consider legalization in terms of, because you always have people that are going to tell you, well, we'll manage to keep it out of the hands of kids, we'll manage to keep it so that people aren't swerving all over the road and killing people and multiplying the drunk driving epidemic times 100. You always get people that are saying we're going to manage to do this kind of stuff, but to me, you ain't banning prohibition if you still have these things here. If you're going to have means to keep it out of the hands of kids, and that to me is a joke anyways, because I think you'll see a black market that'll spring up where the kids will be getting their hands on it and everything like that. So talk about that, as far as this end game, if we ever were to get to that point.
Sure. So where this conversation, I think, has to start is from the recognition that drugs do exist. A lot of people will say to me, "Well, even crack cocaine, you'd even legalize crack cocaine." But look, in a perfect world, okay, there wouldn't be crack cocaine. But this isn't a perfect world, and these drugs do exist. So the best thing we can do as a society is try to reduce the harm associated with these drugs. Now, if you could somehow addiction with, say 10 times the amount of funding, reduce that funding away from enforcement, you might be able to save a lot of families who are wrecked by addiction and wrecked by imprisonment, while at the same time not costing the taxpayer any extra money. Every situation is going to have problems because drugs are dangerous. They simply are. But the problem is that they exist. They've always existed, and they always will. So you have to decide how we're best going to manage it. Yes, people are going to get hurt. That's just an unfortunate reality. We're not going to stamp this out.
Well, people are already getting hurt, and yeah, I mean, I can agree. I mean, I'm somebody who likes to see, you know, some realpolitik in whatever public policy that we're talking about here. Can't let you go tonight, Ryan, without getting into something from your day job here as senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post. Give us your thoughts, please, on the election results we saw last night, what that bodes for the agenda that you are following with your day job on a day-to-day basis on Capitol Hill.
It says that Obama has, for the Congress, he has 1 year to get this economy in shape. People are extremely anxious. The economy is on everybody's mind. He picked the health care fight this year, and maybe that'll turn out to be good for the country and good for him politically. But over the next 6 to 10 months before the midterms, he has to do something about the economy and ease people's fears. And within the next 3 years, he's got to do something about it, or he's going to be a one-term president. People are frightened out there, and as they should be. Businesses are still collapsing. People are still getting laid off. There's been a rally in the stock market, but that's, as you know, it's only because all companies have been just laying people off by the hundreds of thousands. So that's good for their stock for now. But anybody that takes comfort in that, it doesn't recognize what's going on the ground. And the polls showed that 85-90% of people did not take comfort in that and are feeling very uneasy. And I hope that it's a wake-up call to Congress and to the administration and to, the rest of the policymakers that they need to do something about this economy, that people are really hurting out there. What do you think?
They definitely are. And, on the same day you hear about the health care package possibly getting put back into next year now, that's the deadline that just keeps sliding and sliding and sliding.
Sure, things take way more time up there than people like to admit at the outset.
Yeah, everything always ends up being harder than it looks, when you're out there on the campaign trail. And ultimately, we shall see. We're now just a year away from the midterms. We'll see how it goes.
Yep.
But we did definitely find your book to be very interesting, Ryan. That being This Is Your Country on Drugs, The Secret History of Getting High in America, and very enlightening book with some of the conclusions that it draws. And we enjoyed having you on. Now, we look forward to doing it again sometime soon.
I'll be glad to come on anytime.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ryan. All right. Ryan Grimm, everyone, the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post.